Chapter 52. Monsters. Because they did not know his identity, they called him the Monster. It was a fitting epithet, for his crimes were of a diabolical type. These words from Lord Birkenhead's famous trials refer to Renwick Williams, a ripper who terrorised London during the year 1789. And how many murders did this monster commit? None. He was a commonplace sexual pervert who derived satisfaction from slashing women's clothes with a knife. On a few occasions, he accosted a girl and asked her to smell a bunch of flowers. The ones who were incautious enough to accept the invitation had a sharp instrument, hidden among the flowers, jabbed into their faces. An unpleasant character, certainly, but not, by modern standards, a monster. Psychiatrists call such men pickers, and they recognise that they're suffering from sexual frustration and an inferiority complex. The picker is usually obsessed with some part of a girl's anatomy, her breasts, buttocks or thighs. He mingles with a crowd, selects an attractive victim, and then gets close enough to jab her with a sharp instrument, often an ice pick. By the time the girl realises what has happened, he's vanished. For the modern reader, the most surprising thing is that a picker should have caused such terror in London, a terror comparable to that caused by Jack the Ripper a century later. Prostitutes tried to keep their pimp in sight. Respectable women went out only with a male escort. Many of the stories about the monster's exploits were exaggerated, but in fact he was a dangerous man. His knife had inflicted deep and painful wounds, and some of the victims had badly scarred faces. London was seized with panic. Crimes springing from sexual abnormality were almost unknown. They couldn't even begin to understand what could drive a man to attack strange girls. The age of sex crime lay nearly a century and a half in the future. Then, in January 1790, the monster committed the attack that led to his downfall. In St. James's Street, there was a tavern run by a man called Porter. His two attractive daughters, Sarah and Anne, were popular barmaids. But on several recent occasions, Sarah had been upset when a strange man had sidled up to her in the street and had muttered obscene suggestions in her ear. At 11 o'clock on the night of January the 18th, the two girls were returning from a ball when Sarah recognised the foul-mouthed stranger on the corner of St. James's Street. He was apparently drunk. He shouted, "Oh, there you are!" and he gave her a blow on the side of the head. Sarah told Anne to run. "That dreadful wretch is behind us." As they reached the door of the tavern, he caught up with them and slashed at their buttocks with a knife. The girls screamed and rushed inside, but not before they had both seen the man's face clearly. Their dresses and underclothes were soaked with blood, and when they undressed, they found they had long slashes on their buttocks, one of them 4 inches deep. 6 months later, the girls were walking in St. James's Park with their mother and a male friend when the monster walked past them. He obviously recognised them, for he turned and stared. Anne Porter cried, "That's him! That's the man who attacked us!" The man with them then hurried after the monster. He tracked him to a nearby house, banged on the door, and demanded to know the identity of the man who had just gone in. The monster appeared with apparent astonishment, handed over his visiting card, and asked what all the fuss was about. He even agreed to accompany the young man to the house where the Porters lived. At that, Anne and Sarah promptly screamed and fainted. In spite of his protests, he was arrested and in due course appeared at the Old Bailey, where crowds flocked to see the infamous Ripper. The judge had to explain to the jury that this was an extremely baffling case, the first of its kind ever heard in England. There was simply no law to deal with a man who slashed ladies' buttocks without apparent motive. On the other hand, there were plenty of laws to deal with damage to property. So Renwick Williams was charged with damaging the ladies' clothes. The blood-stained dresses and underskirts were produced in court with 10-inch rents to prove that the monster had ruined valuable property. Williams was duly sentenced to 6 years in jail and ordered to produce £400 as a surety for good behaviour in the future. Strangely enough, the next wrongdoer to earn himself the nickname of the Monster was also called Williams, but in his case he deserved the title. He slaughtered 2 families with a frenzy that suggests temporary insanity. Thomas de Quincey has described the case, with magnificent suspense but considerable inaccuracy, in an appendix to his famous essay, On Murder Considered as One of the Fine Arts. The scene was the Ratcliffe Highway in the East End of London, not far from the street where Jack the Ripper would later kill and mutilate six women. The year was 1811. Towards midnight on December the 7th, Timothy Marr, who kept a hosier's shop, sent out the servant girl to buy oysters. 20 minutes later, she returned to find the house locked up. There was no reply to her knocks, but she thought she heard stealthy footsteps inside. Neighbours broke in to find a scene of bloodshed. The apprentice boy lay at the foot of the stairs, his head beaten to a pulp by frenzied blows that had sprayed his brains onto the ceiling. Behind the counter lay Timothy Marr. His wife Celia was in the doorway, face down. Both had had their heads battered and their throats cut. In the basement, the baby had been assaulted with the same fury, its throat also slashed. Nothing of value seemed to be missing from the house. The murders caused panic, not only in London, but all over England. Old ladies in remote parts of Wales had heavy bolts put on their doors. 8 days later, the hysteria increased when there was another mass slaughter within a few hundred yards of the Marr's house. This time it was a publican named Williamson who ran the King's Arms. Shortly after 11 p.m, a lodger named John Turner heard the front door slam heavily. Being of a nervous disposition, he sat up in bed and wondered if the unseen murderer had entered the house. He stole slowly downstairs and saw a man bending over a prostrate body on the floor. In the room beyond, two more bodies lay. Turner crept back upstairs, knotted some sheets together and clambered out of the window. As soon as he was safely on the pavement, he began to shout, "Murder! Murder!" By the time a crowd had broken in, the killer had escaped out of a back window and scrambled up a muddy bank. Williamson, his wife Elizabeth, and the servant girl, Bridget Harrington, had all been killed in the same violent manner as the Marrs. A 14-year-old girl who had been asleep in a bedroom was unharmed. The Marrs had been murdered by a kind of sledgehammer called a maul. It was not until after the second mass murder that this was identified, by initials on its handle, as belonging to a Swedish sailor. The sailor had a perfect alibi, being at sea at the time of the murders, but he had left his tools in a common lodging house, where a man named John Williams now fell under suspicion. On the morning of the Williamson murders, he had returned to a room he shared with other lodgers and shouted at them to put out the candle. The next morning, someone noticed that his shoes were muddy and that he was washing muddy socks. There was blood on his shirt, which Williams explained as the result of a brawl. A search of the house revealed a pair of heavily bloodstained trousers at the bottom of a privy. The pocket of his coat was also bloodstained, as if it had held a knife, and the knife itself was found hidden in a mouse hole. Williams, a fresh-faced man who didn't look in the least like a murderer, was arrested. But before he could be tried, he hanged himself in jail. His body was buried at a crossroads near the scene of the murders, and a stake was driven through his monstrous heart. It's understandable why De Quincey and his contemporaries refer to him as Williams the Monster. The murders were ostensibly motiveless, although it seems probable that a small sum of money and a few other objects were taken, but robbery could hardly explain the ferocity of the murders, or the killing of the sleeping baby. Neither was there any apparent connection between the victims and the killer which might justify a theory of revenge murder. It's not surprising that the Ratcliffe Highway murders obsessed the imagination of the 19th century until they were finally eclipsed by Jack the Ripper 77 years later. But although criminologists still have no idea of what turned Williams into a homicidal maniac, they have an altogether deeper understanding of the psychology of monsters in general. One of the most important insights is owed to the work of the Austrian zoologist Konrad Lorenz. Lorenz did some of the most valuable work with jackdaws. He quickly discovered that when a jackdaw is first born, it looks around for some object on which to fix its affections. Normally, the nearest object would be the mother, but if there's no mother available, the baby will attach itself to whoever, or whatever, happens to be around. This is known to zoologists as imprinting. One baby jackdaw decided that Lorenz was its mother and expressed its devotion to him in embarrassing ways. For example, it waited until he was dozing with his mouth open and then deposited a load of chewed-up worms on his tongue. This need for a mother or father is so great that a baby peacock has been known to fall in love with a tortoise and a baby monkey with a stone. But experiments soon showed that if the baby is denied any kind of parent figure during the first weeks of its life, it becomes incapable of affection, and it develops into what could be called a psychopath. That is to say, it may learn to become a part of a community, but it never learns the basic rules of give and take. Most human beings enjoy giving because they relish giving pleasure to someone they love or like. The psychopath is disconnected. He doesn't love anybody. He looks coldly at other human beings and he calculates what he can get out of them. He can hate, but he doesn't know how to love. Of course, this condition can be produced in perfectly normal people by long periods of emotional strain, but its effect slowly wears off. In the man who is a psychopath through childhood deprivation of affection, it never wears off. Even so, living creatures are remarkably tough. In a remarkable series of experiments with monkeys, the American Professor Harry Harlow discovered that a newly born monkey can become passionately attached even to a wire dummy, particularly if the dummy is fitted up with some kind of feeding mechanism that gives milk. The baby will snuggle up to the dummy when it needs comfort. As it gets older, it turns into a fairly normal young monkey, capable of giving affection like any other. Which seems to demonstrate that the mother substitute doesn't need to do anything, just to be there. However, by far the most serious cause of affection starvation in children is overcrowding. As soon as overcrowding occurs in any animal community, the infant mortality rate soars and psychopathic babies begin to develop, as an increasing number of babies are actively rejected by mothers who just can't cope. Now, this might seem to raise the question of why there were not far more psychopaths in Thomas de Quincey's London. Surely it was as overcrowded and disease-ridden as any modern city. But this is not altogether true. London, and Paris and Berlin, may have been overcrowded, but the capital was still a fairly small place. Indeed, England itself was full of vast open spaces. Moreover, the people who lived in its crowded tenements had deep roots in the community. They were often poor, but they felt that they belonged. A study conducted among American immigrant communities in the 1930s showed that the first generation of Poles, Croats, and so on were remarkably stable, living in communities with other immigrants from their own country and speaking their own language. It was in the second generation that mental instability began to appear, as the young Pole or Russian Jew found himself torn between two cultures. The rate of mental sickness among Negroes who lived in Harlem, in all-black communities, was far lower than among better-off Negroes who moved to partly white neighbourhoods. All this makes it clear why there were so few psychopaths in early 19th century London, why Renwick Williams caused universal panic, why the Ratcliffe Highway murderer became a legend of horror. It's not known what gave Renwick Williams his compulsion to stab women in the buttocks, or what produced John Williams' outbursts of murderous fury, but such people are no longer a mystery. Sexual frustration can take many forms, from stealing ladies' underwear from clotheslines to jabbing strange women with an ice pick, and they're all clearly forms of substitute rape, a symbolic violation. Renwick Williams, the Ripper, was unmarried. Many witnesses described him as polite and gentlemanly, and yet he seems to have been only a tailor's assistant. The picture that emerges is of a shy, withdrawn, rather intelligent man, a social misfit with a fetish about buttocks and overpowering sexual desires that could burst out, usually when he was drunk, in the form of a longing to slash and rip the object of his obsession. This description also fits John Williams to a remarkable degree. Although only an ordinary sailor, he was better educated than the average seaman, he wrote a good hand, and he was well dressed. Disliked by most men, he was a favourite with women. A fundamentally weak person, he was inclined to bursts of violent rage when he was drunk. He had probably been drinking heavily before he killed the Mars and the Williamsons. Some deep frustration suddenly exploded into psychopathic violence that left him exhausted and strangely lethargic, but temporarily free of his obsessions. Modern case histories of similar types suggest that he may have committed other murders, perhaps in the slum quarters of foreign seaports. The modern parallel that suggests itself is the case of Edward Joseph Leonsky, the man whose crimes terrorised the city of Melbourne in Australia in 1942. His first victim was a 40-year-old domestic help, Ivy MacLeod. She was found in a shop doorway on May the 3rd, 1942, her clothes ripped to shreds, her face battered and lacerated, her body bruised. She was strangled, but there was no sign of rape. A week later, the body of a slim brunette, Pauline Thompson, was found on the steps of an apartment house, the clothes torn and the face unrecognisable. Melbourne suddenly realised that it was harbouring a Ripper-type killer, and there was panic. Mrs. Thompson, a policeman's wife, was strangled but not raped. Scarcely a week had passed when, on May the 19th, the body of another woman was found lying in the yellow mud near an American army camp. Her clothes had been ripped off and she had been beaten and strangled, but again, not raped. She was Gladys Hosking, a 41-year-old secretary. This time, however, there was a clue. An Australian soldier had seen an American serviceman plastered with yellow mud near the scene of the crime. Police searched the camp and quickly found a tent with yellow mud on the flap. A crime chemist, Alan Dower, found it to be identical to the clay in which the body had been found. The occupant of the tent, Private Joseph Leonsky, was a baby-faced, blue-eyed giant, universally liked for his gentleness. The strange thing about him was that when he was drunk, his personality changed completely. He began to talk gloatingly about violence, and then, if the mood was on him, he offered to fight anybody in the bar. He was a real-life Jekyll and Hyde. After each killing, he was horrified, and he screamed in his sleep. His description of the killing of Gladys Hosking was typical. He fell into conversation with her as he walked along the road. His shy manners and appealing face convinced her that she had nothing to fear. He had no conscious intention of harming her. He was merely lonely and homesick. He found her voice soothing, and when it was time for them to separate, he suddenly experienced an insane desire to keep her voice. The violence took over like an epileptic fit, and when it had passed, she was naked and bruised and dead. Leonsky was hanged quickly to satisfy Australian public opinion, and little is known about his psychological history. But what's on record is revealing. His mother had been a professional weightlifter from Poland, an immensely dominant woman whose two unhappy marriages had made her bitter. She undoubtedly loved her son, but had she, during those vital early months of his life, treated him as an irrelevant nuisance? She felt that she had to be hard and tough to face the world. She had no tenderness to give her baby. Leonsky developed into a gentle, shy boy with definite artistic leanings. He drew, played the piano, and won prizes at school. But he was always afraid of girls. Almost any snub or rebuke could reduce him to tears. And so again, there is the same basic pattern as in the other two monsters. The misfit, the outsider, not really at home with other men, and burning with frustrations that found total violent release only when drunk. The three murdered women were not the only ones Leonsky had attacked. Three others came forward to tell of being strangled into unconsciousness by him, and a fourth woman related an attempt to rape her in her apartment. Leonsky was a virile male. He wanted a woman badly, but young women scared him. Equally, he didn't know what to do with the middle-aged women he killed. The need for sex got mixed up with his repressed hatred of his mother. It's not true that all monsters are split personalities who kill in a frenzy. Many psychopaths are simply cold. Ian Brady, the Moors murderer, is an example. Interestingly enough, his mother deserted him almost as soon as he was born. But in most cases, the basic cause can be traced back to very early childhood. Perhaps when this psychological trait is something that every mother and father knows about and takes steps to prevent, monsters will again become as rare as they were in the days of Renwick Williams.